So this parsha class is given in memory of Blima Pestel, Bastel Pesach Halevi, and a memory of my father-in-law, Rav Gershon Ben Harav Ben Sion. It's the Torah portion of Shalach, and I'm going to ask you to keep one hand on 940 and turn page to 966. And it might be helpful to take the other end of your bookmark and stick it in there, because we will turn back to it in a few minutes. So what I'd like you to see on page 966 is the portion that we read as part of the Shema, instructing us to make tzitzis. In it, it says as follows, at verse 37, God says to Moshe as follows. Verse 35, Dabar Abnei Israel, speak to the children of Israel. V'amartalem, say to them, Oselem tzitzis, they should make tzitzis. We know what tzitzis are. We're going to see them with some more detail in a few minutes. And then it says in the next verse, V'hoyen lechem letzitzis, you'll have these tzitzis, or isem oisai, or item oto, you will see them, and therefore, v'zachartem et kol mitzvot Hashem. You'll remember all of the mitzvot of God, v'asitem otom, and you'll end up doing them. Not only that, v'lo tatur achrei levavchem v'achrei nechem. You won't go after your hearts and eyes that make you go astray. This way you'll remember to do all the mitzvot, you'll be holy, etc. Now, for more than 50 years, I have been troubled by some things which we could take a look at classic questions. And this is the best way. It says as follows. Why is the name Tzitzit used? So we're just going to see what Rashi says. Rashi says, because there's another interpretation. I'm sorry. Let's go further to the next piece. How does tzitzis lead a person to remember all the commandments? Because I remember the first time learning this as a little kid. And I'm saying to myself, this is too complicated. Look what it says. Because the numeric value of the word tzitzis is 600. Add to this the 8 threads and 5 knots. We have 613, the number of the commandments in the Torah. And that's convoluted. Of course, it adds up. But is that what we're being told? I understand, you eat matzah, you remember the day we went out of Egypt, we ate matzah, okay. I didn't get it. Today, and leading up to today, I believe, the answer to this question. And that's what I'd like to share with you. And this all comes from the teachings of the Tzemach Tzedek, my favorite encyclopedic sect, where all of the writings of the Tzemach Tzedek are organized by topic. So in order to do that, I would like us now to turn back to the beginning of the parasha, page 940. And we're going to scan this part very, very quickly because, number one, we've spoken about it over many years. Simi is going to speak about it in a bit of a different way later on. And at the very end, we're going to demonstrate a connection between the name of the Torah portion and its narrative with tzitzit. Because that's another thing which I sort of wondered, especially as this parasha happens to be my bar mitzvah parasha. Like, why is tzitzit all of a sudden stuck in here? Didn't bother me as much as the first question, because, you know, as guys, we put on tzitzit every single day, wear talis and all that. And I'm looking at them. What am I supposed to see? Anyway, the story, page 940. God says to Moshe that you'll decide on your own to send meraglim, to send spies. Okay, turn page. They cross the land and turn page again. And they come back and they say, we saw the land, we have all this fruit. Turn page, 946. And they start saying that it's too difficult. No worries. They start saying, too difficult for us to conquer the land. Oh, a whole brouhaha goes on. Turn page, 948, chapter 14. All of the people crying that night. And then what happens? Each one said, last line on the page. They all said to each other, page 949 of the last line, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Page 950, right there. What does it say in verse 5? I'm sorry, verse 11. There's a whole discussion with God and Moshe. And God says, you know, let me wipe out these people. From you, I'll start a whole new people. And Moshe says, no, you got to save all these people. You cannot do that. So let's turn page. And page again. I'm sorry, back 952, the end of 952 says, okay, God says, you know what? I'm not going to kill them all. But they are not going to see the promised land. They, meaning the males, because the males were the ones who complained, and except and turn page 954, that my servant Kalev and Yahushua ben Nun, they're going to see the promised land because they were with the program. All is good, and no problem. And he says in verse 29, "Bamidbar hazeh, in this desert, yiplu b'greichem, your corpses will fall." And that's what happened. Every year, on the 9th of Av, the men would dig a grave, they'd lay in it, and they wouldn't. Every year, now I'm forgetting the number, a certain amount of thousands of people, of the men, would not wake up next morning. And finally, in the 39th year, the men who were old enough, they dig their graves, and they woke up next morning. And they thought, ooh, maybe we judged the time wrong. Finally, when they saw the full moon on the 15th of Av, which is some days later, what is 6 days later, or 7 days later, they said, oh, no, God is simply allowing us to live, to go into the promised land. Basically, this is how everybody died out. So this is the story, the story that's the theme of the parasha. So the question is, we're now going to turn to 966 and the Torah portion of Tzitzit, and we're going to keep the Chumash open there. And so the minor question, what's the relationship between this main story of the parasha and Tzitzit? And after Simi does her piece, it will be very straightforward that we'll connect my piece with her piece, and we will see that somehow Tzitzit is an antidote for the sin of the spies. So in order to do that, we're going to keep the Chumash open. I'm sorry, I asked you to have your bookmark, just for those who just walked in, I asked you to have your bookmark on page 1270, but keep it open on 966, all right? So put your bookmark, as I said, 1270, and then 966. We're going to take a look at some of the specifics of Tzitzit and Talit, but there's something that needs to be explained, because based on the teachings of the Tzemach Tzedek, it's going to be explained in a deeper way than I'm about to say now. And that is, let me say, women don't wear Tzitzit. Mm-hmm. So how does this speak to a woman? You know the rule that you're supposed to ask questions. Yeah. You're not supposed to bury them in your head. Really? I'm sorry? Does it have to be raw wool? I don't know why they use raw wool, but they do. Raw wool meaning they have black stripes. But besides the black stripes, it's not colored like other woolen things that you have. And why? I have no idea. Okay. You asked a very important question. Would a talis in another fabric be acceptable? And also in another format, looking more modern. So the reason that it's traditional to use woolen talisim is because there are opinions who say that if it's not woolen, then you don't have tzitzit on them. So if you have something that is non-wool, then you should have tzitzit on it, because we rule, according to the opinions, to say even if it's not wool. But with all mitzvot, we like to do them beautifully, just like we like to have the flowers for Shavuos. We try to do mitzvot nice, which also means that all opinions should agree. But there is one thing that's very, very important, which we're going to talk about later, because it's part of the whole meaning of everything we're going to present. Tzitzit or talit is only kosher if it's a certain size, number one, meaning a certain width, a certain length. And the size is, I'm going to give it to you in centimeters, 48 centimeters, which is 18 inches, by, what's twice 48? 96 centimeters. If it's not that size, then you don't put tzitzit on it, number one. Number two, it must be worn with two tzitzit in the front and two in the back. Now, you can say these are just rules, but in this particular class, we're going to find out that if you remove these things, then the whole message is gone. The message just isn't there. So therefore, I'm glad you raised it and I asked it. I'd like to point out some of the basic reasons why women don't wear a talit. None of these reasons, minus one maybe, will really help you have a take-home message. It's similar when we were learning the garments of the high priest and the regular Kohanim. Well, nobody here is a Kohen. We're never going to be a Kohen. We're never going to wear them. And why would we study it? And it's doubled over in the Parsha. So over the years, we've actually gone directly onto it and to see why it does speak to us. In this particular case, you're going to see when we get there that there's a very special, mystical and practical, all at the same time, reason why this is a message for women, even though they don't wear it. But right now, I'm going to give you the regular. The regular is as follows. There are 613 commandments of the Torah, of which 14 of them are restricted by time. Positive commands that are restricted by time, which fall into the category that women are not required, but for them it's optional. So, for example, eating in a sukkah is a certain time of the year, so it's optional for women. And this is only required during the daytime. We still wear them at night for another reason. It's not for today's class. But it's required only during the daytime. Therefore, women are not obligated. So you might say, what about women opting to wear a talis just like they opt to go into the sukkah to hear the shofar, which is another one of them? Why not? That already has a different reasoning behind it. And I want you to know the technical reason before we go further, which is that in the Torah, the way it's written here on page 966, the way it talks about it, and it's expounded in the Talmud, meaning by examining the wording of the Torah, it's clear that only if you have a garment that follows this criteria, two corners in the front, two corners in the back, only then do you put tzitzit. And actually, it's not so common to have garments that way. So in other words, if you have, let's say, a robe, and even if it has four corners, but all four corners go to the front, you have no tzitzit. So therefore, the sages instituted that we shouldn't forget this mitzvah, that those who are obligated men should wear it every single day. So what happens as a result, that after a few thousand years of men wearing a talit now becomes a male garment. So now you have a whole extraneous but important reason. Cross-dressing is prohibited by biblical law. It's expressly written in the Torah. Okay, so that's a whole different story. It's, after a few thousand years, you can't help it. Meaning to say, most of the decrees that are rabbinic, not all, but most of them happened during the time of the Second Temple era. So I'm going to guess that this one was from that era also. And what that means is that in the desert, probably, they didn't wear it. Which meant during that time, if a woman wanted to, she had one, and she decided, you know, go ahead, just like you go eat in the sukkah, why not? But today, of course, we cannot do that. So that is the technical reason. Now, one of the things that we're going to see after Simi gives a talk is that there's a relationship between tzitzit and the story of the spies. Now, I mentioned before, and I made a point of it for this reason, that who were the complainers? The men. That's why they were the ones who died out, and the women did not. So on this level, the reparation of the concept of the spies is very important for men. This is just on a very basic level. But of course, I'm leaving you in the dark. I have to, because that's only going to come at the end. But in the middle, we are going to get to a deeper meaning, which is that even if you don't wear it, it still has a message for you. And I say you, because I'm a man. So of course, me. But for you, women, here, it has a message as well. So with that, we're going to now take a look at certain aspects of the talit. Now, you know the talit, the way it's worn, as I said before, you have two corners in the front, two corners in the back. So I'm not going to put it on right now. But here I have a different garment that I'm wearing. It's called the capote. And in English, in the garment industry, it's called the St. Albert for a reason that I don't know or it doesn't make a difference to me. You have two corners here. And this is a blend of wool and silk. This particular one is 50-50. So you have two corners here in the front. These corners don't count because the lapel corners, a corner has to have a certain size definition. But if you go to the back, you're going to see that there's a split that goes up over halfway. That's important because jackets that have a split that goes just a little bit, like men regular jackets, that doesn't matter. If it goes over halfway, and some fancy coats that I saw when I was in yeshiva in France, it was sort of stylish to have coats, also woolen coats. So now watch this. You'll notice that I have two corners here. One is rounded off. Why? Because if it wasn't rounded off, then you have two corners in the front, two corners in the back. Now, not all opinions agree that it would require tzitzit, but there are those who say you do. And we're talking about the biblical commandment right now. And especially, I mean, this is, as I said, it's 50% wool. Some of them are 100% wool. Some of them are all silk, which some opinions still say it's a biblical requirement. So what we do is we round it off to get out of trouble, right? Okay, so that is why I put on this kapota. One of the things that you're going to see, and it will relate to what we'll explain later on, is that the talit, you're essentially putting two in the front and two in the back. I'm not putting it on right now because you know what it looks like. Okay, but there's two in the front, two in the back. Here, what you really have is that there's two, it's going sort of side by side. You see that? This side is two, and this side is two, right and left, which it gives rise to different opinions. So having explained that, now going to take a look at the talit itself, and I'm point out some of the things in the construction of the talit. All done by hand, mind you. I'm not talking about the garment itself, that's done by machine. But here, you have on each corner. And what I'm going to do is, Binyamin, if you don't mind, I'm going to stand here between you so everybody can lean over and see. And if you want to get up and see, you can do that, no problem. So do you mind just gently? Okay, good. So here, take a look at this. What you have is four corners. But then you have four hand-spun strings. These strings happen to be made out of eight threads, but we're not going to go there today. And you have these strings, you put four in through the hole, it then bends out the other end, so what you end up is with eight strings, and that's going to become relevant, as we shall see. We also have here knots, K-N-O-T-S, all right? You have knots, and then you have one of these strings that was made extra long, and it is wound around the other seven. In Ashkenazic custom, you have between the first and second knot, you have seven, then for the next knot, eight, then 11, and then 13. And the reason for it is, we're not going to get into now. And in the Sephardic custom, it follows the numeric value of God's name. So they have 10, 5, 6, 5. But the idea is that you have a string called the shamash, and it is wound around the other ones. Now, if you read the Torah portion on page 966, and you go to verse 37, you're going to say that you're going to see that it says that it should have a string of techelet, which is sky blue color. So the techelet is made from a certain amphibian, a sea creature that lives probably in the Middle East. But when Jewish people were exiled, obviously they didn't have photographs to see what it looks like, and they certainly didn't have names, so it was forgotten. So then when Jews move, so then what do? About doing tzitzit, you cannot take that amphibian, cannot make the dye. So we don't use it. I do want to interject this, and I know some people who are listening to the recording are going to object with what I'm going to say, but I've done a fair bit of research, and I'd like to say as follows. In recent times, there are people who've done a fair amount of research to see if they can find the right sea creature with which to create the techelet. Now, I have a number of thoughts on what I've read, but my thoughts are not important. Why not? Because I'm not a world-class rabbi. When I say world-class, I only mean world-class reputation. That's it. Because we are an argumentative people, I don't have to tell you. The scholars amongst us are very argumentative on scholarly points. And when you have a rabbi that the whole world of scholarly Jews respects, you need to pay attention. And to me, the loudest statement on this subject is that not one of the rabbis with a world-class reputation even bothered to comment on those who are producing and selling this blue techelet. And that silence, to me, is the biggest smack in the face. So therefore, I say, do yourself a favor, because according to halacha, if you're coloring it blue and you're wrong, you're in deep trouble. You're in deep trouble. We're talking about a biblical commandment. I mean, the fact that we put it on every day is rabbinic. But once you're wearing it, it's biblical because you have the four corners. You've got to have it. So this is what it looks like. So you have four becoming eight. So a total of eight times four, which is 32. Now, I do want to say, in studying the teachings of the Tzemach Tzedek, there were many points which the Tzemach Tzedek explained that I didn't understand. So I'm not going to share them with you because, you know, I'll tell you a little story. Many years ago, a certain non-Orthodox rabbi was at a bris, and he was the scholarly type. In other words, he would write books. And he came over to me, he leans over to me, and he says, you know, somebody asked me such and such question, and I don't know the answer. I wonder if you know the answer. I made up an answer, but it's not the right one. Yeah, so I gave him the answer. But I heard him say, I made up the answer. And the reason I've never forgotten that, because it's, I don't know how many decades ago, maybe it's 30 years ago almost, or something like that. Why can't you say you don't know? Right? So that's just a side point. Okay, so having seen the tzitzit, after your question, we're going to dive in and get into how this really speaks to us. So just to answer your question, that a tallit is worn on certain other occasions that do not relate to davening, that incidences that require a certain measure of respect. In non-Chabad shuls, in other words, I do not know why this is not the Chabad custom, but it isn't. But in most other shuls, anytime a chazan leads services, he puts on a tallit. At a Brit Milah, the Sandik puts on a tallit. There are other occasions where people think that a tallit should be put on, and it's not necessary to do so. And that's okay, because if you're wearing a tallit, it's the end of the world. It's like wearing two kippot. You know, okay, you don't lose anything. Okay. So now we are going to dive in. Let us remember something that must be appreciated with everything you're going to hear from me. And I am saying this because if I say something and it does not resonate with you the way I'm saying it, then you need to speak up. You need to interrupt me. Okay, here goes. Because the point with tzitzit has to be, like it says, straight, black and white. In verse 39, you'll see them, you'll remember the commandments, and therefore you'll do them, and you will not go astray after your hearts and eyes, which otherwise cause you to go astray. Right? So we're talking about something very real. The question of mine, as I said, for me, it's more than 50 years, and this is a very special class for me because I learned something that almost my entire life bothered me. Here we go. In fulfilling our purpose on this world, there are two general areas. There is all-encompassing aura, and there are specifics. What does that mean? So let's just say, for example, you go into a wedding hall, there's a certain atmosphere. Okay. But now, let's suppose you're not in a wedding hall. And let's suppose we're Canada, so somehow you get plucked out for some reason to be the ambassador of Canada. Where? In Peru. I don't know anything about Peru. But if you're the ambassador for Peru, you're ambassador for Canada, you are going to walk around with an aura around you that I represent Canada. Which means that if I go to the store, and whatever language they speak in Peru, what do they speak? Spanish, probably, yeah? So with my American, Canadian, in my case, it would maybe half British accent, and I, let's say, for example, do something I shouldn't do. I push in the line in the store and, you know, wiggle my way up front. So not only did I irritate people, I just disparaged the entirety of Canada. So what we've just seen here is that specific details relate to the aura. And we've also seen that we can decide to take an aura with us. Now, once upon a time, everyone in this room remembers such a time, except those who are born more recently don't. It used to be that a gentleman, and that's the word used not only in English, but in other languages too. In French, you say a good man. I don't know about Montreal, but at least in France, they say bon homme. Okay? Why a gentleman? Because a gentleman is going to treat a woman like a man should treat a woman. So today, of course, if you say that, they're going to, especially in the country down south, they want to knock your head off because you're not being equal and so on. But I'm saying this for a reason. Why am I saying this? Because civilized people carried an aura with them, the men, of how they should behave. When I was younger, it was the norm that a man wouldn't use four-letter swear words in the presence of a woman. You just wouldn't do it, and so on and so forth. And that's even before opening the door. So in other words, let's go to the tallit. The tallit is something that wraps you front to back. You see how your question about the modern tallit, which are like a scarf, I don't want to embarrass anybody, which is why I don't speak up about it, other than in a class setting where I know that there's no one here who's going to be embarrassed. But the scarf talus, it's like you're removing the whole point. The whole point is, the first thing is, you and I are here on a mission from the Almighty. And that mission is laid out in this Chumash, in the Torah. And we're going to see about specifics soon. But right now, that's the aura. So just like I'm a gentleman, or just like I represent my country, how about representing God who created me? I'm not a man of the jungle. I'm not even talking about being Jewish yet. Of course, I will in a minute. What's the difference between the animals and the people? Well, one way of saying it is that people have a concept that is a complete fabrication. It's called ownership. Something is yours and something is mine. If you go to the animal kingdom, whether it's plants who are fighting to get to the sun or to get the nutrients, yes, or it's the animals, whether they are eating plants or eating each other, there's no ownership. In other words, I'm just in it for me, and it's life and death every single day. That's my struggle. If you're a human being, you can say, well, we're all just mammals and so on and so forth. No, we're not. We carry an aura around us, which it says in the beginning of the Chumash, be fruitful and multiply, fill the world and harness it. So you could, for example, use technology to how to do cyber theft, or you could use technology to help everybody on this planet. Jewishly, of course, we go to a whole new level. Because Jewishly, what God says to us is, I'm putting you here in this world to inject sanctity into the mundane activity. And I would like you to be my ambassador. People walk around and says, there goes a Jew. I'd like to tell you a little incident that happened with me. I've told it once before, but it's not a big deal, and this is why I'm telling it. It's a small deal. So I have a bunch of things in a store, and it's the aisle that says, Express, 15 items or less. So I'm the next one in line. They're about to, and the woman behind me says, this is the express lane. Now, I could have snapped at her and said, if you count my items, you'll see 13 items, which there was exactly 13 items. And I was tempted to, but at that split second, I remembered. You see the way I look? Okay, I have a beard, I have everything. I represent something. I represent God's mission to the world. I didn't say a word. I went afterwards and looked at my receipt, and I just waited around. When this lady was finished and she was away from the till, I walked over to her. I said, excuse me. And I showed her my receipt, and I showed her there are 13 items. She apologized. Now, this is not really a big deal, but here's what I'm saying. I'm saying this is, if we remember that we carry an aura around us, now the details become the way they're supposed to be in accordance with the mission. So now, how are the tzitzit? You wear them around you, front and back, and from the aura, it goes down to details. First of all, four corners, and we're going to get into the meaning of two in the front, two in the back, and within those corners, you have more sub-details. Four strings becoming eight. And within those eight strings, you have that string which wraps around them. It used to be sky blue, as I said before, and now it isn't. So what we want to do now is we want to take a look at what is the meaning. Because remember what I said? It has to speak to all of us. And at this point, I'd like to inject why, on a mystical level, a woman can learn from tzitzit even though she doesn't wear them, as I spoke about before. And this is not because I say so, but the Tzemach Tzedek, close to 200 years ago, wrote what I'm about to share with you. And was he apologizing for somebody in the shtetl of Lubavitch somewhere in Russia where they just needed that there should be no more pogroms, where the Tsar was rounding up little Jewish kids and stealing them to the army? No, he wrote it because this is what God's intent is. And the idea is as follows. a man needs to be reminded about his aura. He needs to be reminded about his details. But now I'm going to say something about women. And you'll all excuse me because I'm a man. I'm going to use my language. But you're going to see that what I'm about to say now is much more true than even a man can appreciate. So, for example, if I moved into a home and it had just a bare floor and just plain walls, I'm telling you straight, I would be happy and it's fine. And then what happens? Okay, but if you're married, your wife comes along, we got to create an aura. Maybe she doesn't say it, but that is, but it's not only that. When I was a little kid, I, for the life of me, could not understand. And this is before digital watches and before all of this blurring of distinctions. Every woman on the planet had a watch that was so small that even with a magnifying glass, you can't read it. And I'm saying to myself, what is this? Do they want to know the time or they don't want to know the time? Well, one day, I got married. And my wife has a watch, a nice watch. Pretty nice one. And, yes, okay, yeah. But here's what happened. Here's what happened. It was a clockwork watch, which we all remember. Those things do break. So once upon a time, when we were all younger, there was a watchmaker, you go and you'd get it repaired. What happens when you have no more clockwork watches? You have no more, nobody can repair it. So how do you find the new guts for such a thing? And here's what I noticed. She would still wear it. Oh, why? Because somehow, now get this. Imagine you have a diamond watch, yeah? And you have, I don't know, let's just pick on a number. Let's say you have 30 little diamond chips around it. And let's say two of them fell out. I don't know. I think, you could tell me I'm wrong, maybe some women, they wouldn't wear it anymore because that little chip is out. It's missing something. So in other words, what I'm saying is, not what I'm saying, what the Tzemach Tzedek points out, that in the feminine approach to divine service, there is a natural awareness of your aura, and there's a natural sensitivity to the proper balance and details, the exactitude of your details, that everything should be just right. So you have a cake and it's beautiful, and then somebody comes in and says, wow, that's a cake. I made it for my grandson. But then you have to apologize because one of the drizzles sort of slipped off. And now is when the chocolate drizzle is covering a little part on the white drizzle, which it's not supposed to. So you have to apologize. You made a whole cake. It took you 20 hours, right? Yeah, until you found the right pattern and everything. But the little drizzle went off track. You got to make a whole apology for the cake. So in other words, the messages of tzitzis are for men and women, except that men are in that respect much more physical, meaning to say, if you're a man and you've ever done an oil change, you understand that that's a very pleasurable activity. I know you're all cringing, all the ladies, right? But I'm telling you the truth. On that, I still remember the first time, and I bought these things, and I drove up my car, and in the garage, underneath the car with a special wrench, and did the whole, I still remember the first time. It's so many years, I mean, I don't do it anymore. But do you see what I'm saying? So we need a physical reminder. And the women don't need a physical reminder. But the concept is identical for all of us. So now, given that we understand the aura, and we understand that it goes to details of four, and then to further details, eight, and so on, let's take a look at some of the meaning of those details. So this way, you're wearing a talis, and if you are cogent, and you think about what you do, you can look at the talis and it can be a daily reminder. When you walk around this planet, whether somebody's looking or not, you're still the ambassador of the Almighty. You're carrying that aura with you. And since you're carrying that aura, every detail reflects on the general aura. As I said, that if I push in line and I'm dressed this way, or if I would have yelled back at that lady, even though I would have been right, I wouldn't have been a proper ambassador of the Almighty, right? So therefore, with that in mind, let us now go into some of the meaning of the details. As I said, there's a lot more, but I can only share those parts which I understood and understood how to bring them down to the practical. So what is the meaning of the four corners? Well, the four corners has a number of meanings. All of these, anytime you have four in Judaism, they're always interrelated. So for example, You have the four corners of the earth. Well, the world isn't square. We understand. We're talking about directions, yes? Basically, instead of saying north, south, west, east, I'll say forward, backwards, right and left. Okay, no matter where you are. You have those directions, which again, you're hearing front and back, right and left. Okay, so now, for those who are more mystically minded, I'm going to inject also in this case that in the mystical teachings, it says that, in fact, in the prophecy of Ezekiel, it talks about what he saw, and of course, it's using metaphors. I'm just going to throw out these words because I know that we have some people here who come to the Kabbalah class, so I'm throwing it in there for their benefit, but I will still translate it for our purposes. He says he beheld the God's divine throne, and on it there were four faces: the face of a man, the face of a lion, face of an eagle, and the face of an ox. So obviously, there's no physical anything there, because if that's on God's throne, then God's physical, and I don't believe him, and then I'll be a Greek. You know, so maybe I'll just buy another God that helps me out this day. Rather, it's a metaphor, of course. So what is the meaning? The meaning is as follows. Right and left, just like we have right-handed, left-handed. The right hand means dexterity, the ability to project. And if you're left-handed, then from a mystical point of view, your left hand is technically your right hand in this context. So the right hand means projection, forward, passion. That's why it's called the lion. And the left, of course, it has movement, it has dexterity, but less so. Why? Because it's relied upon for stability. Like you could take an ox, and of course the ox could go wild, but you can harness the ox and then you can plow a field. And I think the best example I could think of is like this. In England, like the rest of Europe and most of the world, the game that everybody goes crazy on is not hockey and it's not baseball. It is soccer. People kill each other, they go nuts over it. When you play soccer, here's how you kick the ball. Because remember, the whole craziness of the whole world of sports depends on the right and left foot. Before you kick and score a goal, like Pele, if any of you remember who he was, who could score a goal in the World Series from across the halfway line, right? Even though I wasn't a big soccer fan, but that much I knew about Pele from Brazil. Yeah, from Brazil. So he stands on his left foot and he shoots with his right. What would happen if his left foot would buckle? Pele wouldn't be around and nobody could play soccer, you see? So that's the meaning of the left, or which is like the ox. You have sturdiness, reliability, measured, right? You have to stay in this position. You have to pivot exactly this way and keep it there for the right amount of time, and then you spring forward, right? So you have right and left. And then you have front and back. Front and back. So front means what is the face impression of anything and what's behind. Now, behind can mean a few things. Behind can mean what's the subtext, in which case behind is deeper. Behind can also mean what you reject. So the face of the eagle in this context represents mercy. Now you say, well, if you watch those eagles, how they eat others and fish and whatnot, they're not merciful. We're not talking about that point. We're talking about the point of how an eagle protects its young, described in the Torah as hovering above the nest to protect it from anybody, including human beings who want to shoot it and take the little eggs and so on. So that would be forward, but forward not just like a lion, which can also be vicious, but there's mercy. But the back, believe it or not, the back corresponds to the face of the man. The man is the last in creation, but the first in focus in God's intent. Why? Because the man is the one who can decide to be firm. He can decide to be God's ambassador. He can decide all these things because he has intellectual commitment. Intellectual commitment. The reason other animals only do what they do, because that's their computer programming. That's how they're programmed. They can't do anything about it. So we have these four corners of the talit. In other words, we're taking the aura and we're saying that in my life, there are four general modes of behavior. There is drive. There is being modulated. In other words, how do I do it? Here I'm going to make a move. Here I'm not. Like the left foot. Just think of the person shooting the soccer ball, right? That's the right versus the left. And front and back. front is I see a person's situation, so therefore it arouses me to mercy, but then there's always a subtext in the back. Now, ironically, the one who can have intellectual commitment can also be the worst, in which he becomes the back on a different level. You see, from the highest to the lowest. Who can do more damage to this world than people? I mean, how many people have been killed by people? And how many people have been saved by people, right? So you have those two opposites. So when we take about the aura of being God's ambassador on this world, we need to watch our modes as we just described those four modes. But now, when we get into some more detail, because you see what's happening, going from overall aura to general modes, and then we're going to take those modes and we're going to take it down to even a lower level of behavior. You take four strands of wool and you thread them in to the corner, it becomes eight. What does that mean? Now here I did forget to bring a Sephardic Siddur, which is in the shul, to show you, and I won't get it now because this is the part that I would show is not so relevant, even though it connects, but those who come to the Kabbalah class will understand it a bit of a deeper level. So there are two modes of how things, of why we do anything here. And I'll give you an example. In the Torah, in the laws of tort, which means damages, okay, I bashed into your car, now I have to pay you. That's tort. So you have certain laws, and I'll pick just one. Let's say witnesses. The Torah says, two witnesses. You have to have two witnesses to establish a fact. The Torah also says that if you have 100 witnesses, or two witnesses, they're just as powerful, which means, let's say you have witnesses to a car accident. You have 35 people. Seven people say like this, and the other 28 or 29, they say it was like that. What do you have? You have two equally powered groups, and they cancel each other out. Now, you may say, well, that doesn't really does. That's not logical. And that's why I brought this up. The idea that you need witnesses who you're going to cross-examine to establish a fact, of course, that's very, very logical. That is the divine wisdom coming down into logic. But there's a component which is a decree of the Almighty, which is one of the ways God reminds us that it's not just for humanistic or intelligent reasons. There's a divine component that's beyond you. Meaning to say, just like you accept that these two groups, 7 versus 20, however many, will cancel each other out, and it's not logical, you say, but that's how God decreed it, so we're going to have to figure out this case in a different way. The same way, even what is logical to us, that we do need witnesses to establish a fact, is also divinely ordained, just because it also happens to be logical. And this applies to many, many things. So, for example, people can tell me from today till tomorrow that it's much healthier to keep kosher. And I'll tell you the truth. I learned something about kosher meat. That kosher meat is much more bland in and of itself, but it also has a lot of salt, which is another type of a flavor. Why is it more bland? Because non-kosher meat, they don't drain the blood by salting. So you have blood left over in the meat, and in the blood, you have a component, you can look it up, called urea. You'll excuse me. Urea is urine, basically a urine component in the blood, which gives the meat its tanginess. And in kosher meat, you don't have it. So you want to say it's healthier to eat meat without having urine. I'm sorry to be so blunt. You could say that's a good idea. You could say so. But the truth of the matter is, that's not why we do it. We do it because God said so. So now, when we are God's ambassador, we have in the details, right, left, front, back, we have in each one, four that becomes eight. What's the meaning of four that becomes eight? You have two names of God. One is spelled with a yud and a hey and a vav and a hey, four letters, which essentially means God above nature. In other words, God where past, present, and future comes together, because in Hebrew, the word haya, hoveh, yihyeh, those three words, past, present, future, when you truncate them and you condense them into each other, you get that name of God, which we're not allowed to pronounce. You have another name of God with four letters, Aleph, Daled, Nun, Yud, which means God's mastery over the world, which means God's involvement in the world. And in the Sephardic Siddurim, which I didn't bring to show you, every time it says the name of God, they print it in such a way where you see the interrelationship of those letters. Because really, there are many opinions who say that in Jewish law, when you recite that name of God, you should have that in mind. So for our purposes, what it means is that when we interface with the world, everything we do will have two components. Sometimes one is more apparent, some the other one is more apparent, but we need to know that they're both there equally. In other words, we start off with the four strands, which represents the four letters of God's name above nature, and we bend it, so we end up with eight, and those eight, they mix into each other. This just becomes a group of eight, because the eight is four and four, God above nature, God within nature. So what does it mean for me? It means like this. Let's go back to Safeway for a second, and this time, it's a little different. Somebody is just after me, and they just finished paying, and I see that they drop a dollar onto the floor. Okay. I could say to myself, I'm a mensch. Well, let's say it's $100, just to make it more tempting. Okay? $100 bill. I'm a mensch. I pick up. He says, excuse me, madam, sir, I think you lost $100. Okay, I could do that. Or I could say, I'm God's ambassador. See, we're going back to the aura, you see? So now I'm going to take action. I'm going to be like the right side. And I'm going to be merciful. Why do I say merciful? You see, just because the eagle, that's representing mercy, and the lion, which is representing passion forward, I'm going to take the initiative, and I am going to give God a good name because I represent God. And I'll see. I could have waited till Mr. or Mrs. got into the car and drove off and then said, whoops, ooh, I just noticed $100 over there, and take it. And I look around, is it yours? Is it yours? Is it yours? And put a little show, stuff it in my pocket. And who knows the difference? You see, so this is the point, that we can get into the details of this world, but we can just be what's ethical. Ethical, by whose standard? I don't know, because 2018, this is considered ethical, you know, ethical. Or we can say, I'm living in the world, but there's also God above the world. So now when we understand this, let's take a look. What does it say? You're going to have a garment, and it has four corners. And you're going to put on tzitzit, and you're going to look at it, and it's going to remind you that there's of the mitzvot. It reminds, because when you wear it, you're putting on an aura. That's what you're doing. And it has those details. Certain times in the tzitzit, you hold them, and you kiss them when you're reciting the Shema. And one other thing I forgot, which is the blue thread going around. See, the white wool represents kindness, generosity. That's a much better word, because generosity can be good or not good. In other words, if I give my kid a mobile phone, they have full access to the internet, and the little kid, not the wisest thing to do. Okay. You wrap it around by a colored thread, and why blue? We'll leave that right now just because time. But the colored thread going around it represents definition, meaning to say, don't just be generous without thinking about it. Be generous in a proper way, in a measured way. So this way, you know what? When you're this in this age, I'm going to give you the key to the house. Right? Don't give it. You follow what I'm saying? So therefore, you look at the tzid and you remember the mitzvot, because that's really what everything is about. And now this goes back to what I said earlier. So the women not wearing the tzid, because the nature of a woman is to always be conscious of the aura and always be conscious of the details. Right? And just for some of the men who might be listening to this recording, why else would a woman pluck her eyebrows if nobody's around? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm talking now as a man, right? You see what I'm saying? So all of a sudden, I know, my wife doesn't like when I do these things, but this is the point. Because I do, sitting on this side of the aisle, so to speak, you hear how we think, right? To us, this is, honestly, to us guys, it's kind of, I won't say insanity. I shouldn't. It's not nice. But really, we just, you know, give me a break. Right? But anyway, so this is why, finally, after more than 50 years, this message, whether you need to wear tzitzit to remember it, or you remember it without wearing it, all of a sudden, now it makes perfect sense. So this is my discovery, thanks to the third Rebbe of Chabad, the Tzemach Tzedek, after more than 50 years, literally, of looking for an answer. And when Simi's finished her piece, then I'm going to be able to tie it to the very beginning of the parsha, and that's how we will close. Yeah, you're right.
Okay, the time is much shorter than I thought, so we're going to have to truncate it, and it does actually dovetail very well with a lot of what you said. We'll just see if we have time to make all the connections. Last week, my kids were here, thank God, Yosef and Rivki, and I caught myself on the way, as they were leaving the house, I caught myself doing what mothers often do. And I said, we said our goodbyes, and I said, don't work too hard. So Rivki is very, to the point. She says, why not? And then they drove away. And then I continued, and I texted to her. I said, you know what? I thought about it. Actually, with your job, work hard just to bring Mashiach, because that's what we're here for. That is what this working hard is all about. So I was thinking about my friend Sheldon was in Austria, in Vienna, Austria, at the Great Synagogue. I don't know how many of you have been there. Of course, in time when the Jewish community was burgeoning in Austria, it was a shul that was amazing, that was packed all the time. But today, it's a beautiful edifice, but sadly, it's very empty. And he said, wouldn't you believe it, Simi? I went to shul that Shabbos, and the shul was like, it has 3,000 seats. I sat down, I see the shul's basically empty, there's the rabbi up on the podium, the president up on the podium, all the people who have to sit on the podium, they're all up there. Shul is basically empty. It's interesting, we with our tiny shul and our struggle for a minyan, sometimes I say to myself, let's stop for a second and think about these huge shuls that are empty. So with the 3,000 seats, most of them were empty. But wouldn't you know it, he said, someone comes up to me and taps me on the shoulder and says, you're in my seat. Oh, 3,000 seats, probably 2,159 at least are empty. But you're in my seat. Do we spend our life defending our turf? Or do we realize that we have a broader mind to realize that maybe it's not for us to defend our turf. Maybe it's for us to look around at all the other, at all the 2965 or whatever that are left. Is that maybe what we're supposed to be doing? We're supposed to be making all the others around us feel comfortable to sit in our seat. Maybe that's what it's about. Or maybe we're supposed to be in another seat and we just thought we belong in this seat. So what is it about? And my husband just reminded me that Ray actually had this, our friend Ray, had this actually happen to us.
To her.
To her. In fact, the rule usually goes is, if we spend our time demanding this is our seat, demanding justice, usually the more we demand, the more we have the justice that has to happen to us, right? We have to catch ourselves and realize, what is it all about? Is it about sitting in that seat? Or is it about having someone come and sit in our seat? And a word that I learned early in our marriage, jettison our approach, to realize that, hey, maybe that was the path I thought was for me, but no, I was really supposed to sit in this seat and see it from this vantage point. So Rabbi Fischel Schechter tells a story about how he was in the mountains. He had a job in one of these Jewish camps, and he had to be there at a certain time every morning. He had to be there for the boys. He had to be there in time for their davening. And every once in a while, when he was driving, he would see there was, and it's very normal, at least it used to be. I don't know if it's still safe to do it. But in the Catskill Mountains, where there's lots and lots of Jewish life going on during the summer, people, put their thumb out or just basically, looking for a ride to get somewhere. A lot of people don't have cars. And he said he would often, there was this elderly man that would often stop him, and he would gladly stop, give him a ride, but he said it took ages, especially with his broken, beaten up car that was like, the kind of cars, like I just drove someone's car recently where, it's one thing, you lean over to try to give someone a ride, so you open the door, and then they hop in, especially in New York, people are constantly honking, so if you're stopping for a second to let someone in, it's just like 20 cars behind you, beep, no, I know with my mother, you have to get the walker and you have to help her. And I feel like just putting up one of those signs, road work here and, everyone stop. Anyway, so he said that when he would, yeah, it's total, like people have lost, they've they've just lost the vision of what this, what the mission, where the trip is for anyway. What are we taking this road to? So anyway, he said he usually would stop at the guy. He'd have to help the guy into the car, put in the walker, you know, and then till he got, and then usually the car door. Getting back to that car that I was driving, it doesn't work when you just lean over to try to pick up the button and the automatic thing doesn't. I'd have to go around, open up the back door, go from there with the window open, and then, you know, that kind of thing, and get the front door open. So I can imagine he had one of those cars or worse, and then to pick up this guy, it would be a whole long procedure. But he normally did it with a good heart and all that. But that day, he knew he was running so late. And he said, and I am only telling the story because he told it himself publicly. He said he just sort of whizzed by. And just knowing that he just had to. This was his job, and there were all these few hundred boys that were counting on him, and he just couldn't take the extra time. But he felt guilty. And he looked in the rearview mirror. He felt at least a little better. He saw another guy stopped to pick up this elderly man. So, okay, now he could breathe. What happens? He continued driving a little bit, and there's road work. And the guy, you know, with the red flag, stop. So here, all that time that he thought he would have taken up picking up the guy, stop, and he is sitting there, and he's going out of his mind, what am I going to do? But it's interesting, he noticed behind him was like one of those, another truck, a cement truck, and it is. But the guy who picked up the elderly man, he was behind enough on the line that he saw what was going on. He was able to make a left and go around. And when he came to the shul, the old man was already sitting with his talis and davening, you know. So we think we know where the road is taking us. We think we know our path. We know our mission. But do we really know? And perhaps the whole idea of the journey was to take the detour and stop for this man. Maybe that's all it was about, to sit in the other seat. There was a story with the Baal Shem Tov, who one day he was sitting sort of with his chassidim, and all of a sudden he gave a laugh, like out of nowhere. He was just laughing. It was like, you could see he was in another world. And his chassidim asked him, what happened? What was funny? He says, you know that Paritz, the landowner, the one who makes such trouble for Jews and all of that, his whole mansion, he was building this mansion for years, and he hasn't yet lived in it, and the whole thing just collapsed. And people were surprised, like the Baal Shem Tov laughing about someone's misfortune. You know, he said, so why is the Rebbe laughing? He says, I'm not laughing at his misfortune. He said he was building this thing and building this thing at the same time that he's rotten to everyone else. But he said one day, while they were building, they had this awning that they had made, and a certain great tzaddik, a great rabbi who was passing by, he needed to pray, and it was raining hard, and he used that awning as a shelter, and he did his prayers. And as soon as he left, it seems the builders hadn't done a very good job in meshing, you know, the two different halves of the building, and the whole thing collapsed. And I was just laughing at the way God's humor, that this building had to be done, worked on it for so many years, for this one great rabbi to come here, get some shelter, do his prayers, and as soon as he was finished, the whole thing went kaput. You know, so again, we think we know what the trip is about, and often we really don't. I've had times in my life where I've been on a trip in that Brooklyn, which is terrible, crazy to drive, and then someone stops and asks for a lift, and, you know, you could tell who's safe. And so I feel so good when I'm there and I can give someone a lift, and if she needs a hospital, even though I'm not going to that side of town at all. And I get home and I say, okay, so I thought I had to go there, but really, I guess that's where I had to go. And for whatever reason, I had to meet this woman and hear her story. So in our life, sometimes we might say, well, okay, so we have to have faith in the journey, but we also have to put in we are living in a real world, in a human world. And as the rabbi spoke, I think a little bit about the whole story with the Meraglim, with the spies, about the challenge of these great people who were pulled, that they did not want to go into a land where they would have to toil, they would have to weed, they would have to sow, they'd have to seed, they would have to grow, they'd have to do business. And we've spoken about this issue many years. So that is why they ended up with this whole story, talking about the land and saying it's a land that's going to swallow its inhabitants, and everything that they did to try to prevent the Jewish people from going into the land of Israel, because they forgot that this is the road that God really wants us to take. It is about the journey. And in fact, and although I really had this for the end of the class, and I know I've said this many times, but I think each year we have to repeat it, the women, as my husband was talking about just now with the mitzvah of tzitzis, the women did not fall into this pit. They did not lose sight of the goal. Women realized that that itself is the journey. It's not about being this Kohen Gadol, about being this high priest, being on your pedestal and not getting your hands dirty. It is about actually getting your hands dirty, involving yourself in real life, and realizing that someone sitting in your seat, that is what life is about. How are you going to deal with it? How are you going to deal with the daily tests? So then in that case, what is the faith about? What do we need to, we have to deal in the, you know, we have to get our hands dirty and we have to actually sow and reap and seed. So then the faith, what that is for, and of course this is pretty self-understood, is for the peace of mind that it gives us, knowing, as my husband said, that you can have, we know that you can have a case, and to regular, someone in regular law, they would say 7 against 29, as you just said, makes absolutely no sense. Of course, the 29 should win. But that's where the faith comes in, that we're on our journey, and some things don't make sense in our regular, in the regular realm of things and the norm. But that's where we're on a higher plane. We have our faith, and we say, you know what? Hashem knows. This right now doesn't look so balanced, but this is the road. You know, the key, it's like, sorry, you know, when you take a child, unfortunately, to a specialist, any doctor, but especially a specialist, they have these beautiful waiting rooms with lots of toys and lots of things to do and the video, and you're busy. And then comes, okay, it's your turn, sir. You know, and the young man, and he has to pull himself away from all these toys and from all this fun that he's having. Oh, no, that I thought I could stay here, right? But the point is to get into the specialist's office. That's what it's all about. So the Midbar, this big desert with the Anane HaKavod, with the clouds of glory, where our clothes were taken care of and our food was taken care of and everything was taken care of, the water was taken care of, that's just the waiting room. The real thing is getting into the specialist, getting our hands dirty, and going through the therapy that we actually need to get into. You know, it's like a key. Person has a key on your, at least the old keys that we had that were not electronic, right? There's all these different jagged edges. So if a person would take the key out of their pocket and they'd say, okay, let me smooth this key. I don't really like it, you know, especially since it pokes a hole in my pocket. So they take the key and they'll smooth it out. But chacham, it's not going to work. Try and put it now into the hole, into the lock that you have to get it into. It's not going to work. Because your key is, it's individual. Your key has to have those jagged edges, and it has to have it exactly where those jagged edges are. And that's going to be our journey. That's our trip into the land of Israel, where we have to sow and seed and plant. And I'm going to keep repeating that, because that is the message of this parsha, is that this is the journey. Don't lose sight and don't think, oh, hey, I want to just stay on a pedestal. I want to just stay and live this spiritual life in La La Land. It's not like that. You have to actually, like the Friedrich Rebbe, the previous Rebbe, when he came to America, he said, Mach da Eretz Yisrael, make here, elevate it. Obviously, there's no, America is not Israel. But the, wherever you are, elevate it to that level so that we should finally get to the ultimate goal. You remember the Wrigley's gum? They still sell Wrigley's gum? Yeah. Well, Wrigley's gum, I remember when I was growing up, there was always advertisements on all the billboards. It was Wrigley's or cigarettes. Today, I don't think you can have those same cigarette advertisements. But so Mr. Wrigley was in a helicopter, and someone asked him, like, why are you constantly advertising? People are chewing your gum anyway. I, you know, as a kid, I didn't know if there really was any other, but I knew everyone was always chewing Wrigley. So he says, you see these propellers in the helicopter? You see how they keep going and they keep going and they keep going? What if they stopped for a little bit? You know, we'd fall. He said, so yes, people are chewing, but I have to keep going and going. I have to keep letting them know, keep advertising, because you have to keep going, otherwise you fall. And while we're up there with the helicopter, just my husband mentioned about how, about the eagle protecting its young. The interesting way about the eagle and the way it protects its young is very different. The other birds hold on to their young below them. They hold on very tightly. Whereas the eagle, how does it protect its young? Because it is the greatest of all birds, it says, Ve'esa etchem al kamfei nesharim. It says, God, how is he going to protect us and how he's going to take us to the land of Israel? Eventually, it says, on the wings of an eagle, on top. The way that the eagle protects its young is it puts its young on top, because this way, if anyone shoots, it shoots the eagle first, not the young. And the eagle, the young are on top of his back. So what is that about? And how does that, why does God use that type of a comparison for the way he protects us and the way his relationship is with us? Is that God also protects us by keeping us above, protecting us from those elements below. But it's still our choice. Just like the eagle's young still have the choice. The mother is protecting them. But the little young can still fly away. They have that choice. The eagle is flying, the young are on top, and the young can say, okay, that's enough. I've had enough of my mother, of this big, great, great force protecting me. I'm just going to go on my own. And the same thing with the Jewish people. God gives us that. He gives us the tools. He gives us the keys. But we have to realize that we have to use the keys. We can't just smooth out the key. It's not going to work. We can decide. We can just fly away. But if we want it to work, we have to take the tools that he gives us. He gives us this, the land of Israel, in this case, with the Meraglim. In the case of the spies, it was, I'm giving you this because this is the journey that you need. This is the seat that you need to be moved to. The one that you thought, that's not really good for you. It's a story of, I see it's getting late. Just one second. Just to bring out the point a little stronger, for those of us who have been busy with weddings with our children, we know that it takes a lot. And of course, people who really get lost can really have it take a lot. So when I say it takes a lot, I don't mean it has to be the most glorious with every flower and every trapping, but even a simple wedding takes a lot. You know, there's things that we're busy preparing. You know, are there going to be, what kind of meal are we going to serve, and what kind of, you know, how many people they're going to be? Are we having seating plan? Are we having flowers? How many flowers? All sorts of physical things that we're busy with. And if you really think about a wedding, it has nothing to do with any of that. A wedding is really about our children, this young couple. How are they going to have a marriage? How are they going to lead the next link on the chain? How are they going to, what's their family life going to be? So we could say, like it's crazy, you know, why are we so, I mean, thank God, those people who keep their head on their shoulders, they say, you know, this is stuff I just have to sort of get over with, not get too involved in. Thank God, I know with my children, I was so proud of them that they just, you know, okay, Ma, whatever it is, I'll just show up and it will be fine. And that's really the way to go, because if you get too lost into it, but that's not my point today. The point is, why is it that things like weddings, that they do take so much involvement of ourselves, involvement, money, involvement of effort, involvement in worldly things, is because then we've invested an effort and we have this investment that we want to protect and that we're going to pray to God with all our might, so that when we stand there under the chuppah and when we marry them off, and hopefully every day we pray to God and we say, there's so much invested here. Let it all be good. And of course, obviously you take that on different levels. It's not about the money that we spent on the wedding, and it's the whole package that we've invested so much of our lives. And the more we invest, the more we realize that we are reliant on God for everything. And that's the same thing with the land of Israel. God made it with, in general in life, we aren't going to live in a desert. We don't live in a land where we have the clouds of glory and we have all those other miracles, because we have to be invested in this life so that we realize how much we are reliant on God for everything to turn out right. We can just try, but it's not the real thing. And I think I'm going to finish with one more. We'll do one more and we'll see if we have time for the last one. This king who calls a lot of his workers together and he says, I want you to empty out this pond. It's full of water. It's a nice big pond. I want you to empty it out. And I'm giving you only use these tools. And he gives them each a bucket. And they start to empty out the pond. And they see that whatever they're doing, it's worthless, because these buckets that he gave them are full of holes. And so, like, they're doing it, but they realize there's no purpose in this. What is this whole exercise about? What kind of crazy king do we have? One guy continues on the job, and he continues, and he continues, and he's getting nowhere, but he's still doing it. And so people asked him, like, fool, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? You see, the water that you're drawing up is just going straight through. And he says, that's okay. I'm getting paid. I'm a day worker. The king gave me this job, and this is what he told me to do, so I'm going to keep doing it. And when the king came and he saw that this one lone fellow is actually doing what he asked, he commended him and he praised him and he rewarded him. Why? Because he says, the job wasn't for them to actually get the pond emptied. It was for them. I really wanted all those pails washed, yeah. Right? Okay, for whatever reason, he didn't say it. He wanted to see if they had the faith. Sometimes we think our job is to empty the pond, but really our job is to get the pails washed. We think we're going somewhere for a certain reason. The Meraglim had a job. The spies had a job. They were supposed to go to spy out the land. They were not supposed to go to give a report to say if we could do it or not. There was no question. God could do it, all of it. They didn't even need spies for it. Their job, their mission was to go and just use the pails, get the pails washed. For whatever reason, we know, and I'm not getting, my husband's more, you know, speaks about this more in Kabbalah. Sometimes we have to make a keli. We have to make, it's an interesting analogy when I'm talking about empty pails that have holes. But sometimes our job is just to do the job, not to worry about the results. And just to finish off with one last thing, because this is really the kicker in a language that we can all understand. So this guy is having a very, very hard time with his weight, and it's really, really affecting his health terribly. He went to a special doctor for weight loss, and he's on a certain plan. He's discussing with his doctor that Shavuos is coming up, the holiday that we just finished, with the cheesecake and the blintzes and all of that stuff. And the doctor says, well, you know, obviously you can't have any of that. That's just like, you just can't have it. It's really, really detrimental to y'all. He says, but you know, this is my job. This guy was a caterer, and the job that he had was he's going to be making all these cheesecakes and blintzes and cheese kugels and cheese whatever. And the guy says, well, you know what? You're going to have to give up your job. There's no way it's going to work. You cannot be involved in baking cheesecakes and blintzes and who knows what for days and not touch it. It's just impossible. So the guy says, well, actually, I do have a solution. I don't have to resign my job. And I should really, and I often tell this one to myself, I just don't do it. He says, all I need to do is before I start my day, eat a piece of chicken. Right? And then 6 hours later, eat another piece of chicken. And I often say this to myself in a different respect. I don't, you know, I'm not making cheesecake every day. But that idea, isn't it something that if we have the tools, if we decide to use them, this is seems like, you know, a more trivial, though it's not trivial for many of us, situation. We have the Torah. We just have to actually use the tools that have been given to us, and it will work so that we won't be saying, why is he in my seat? But people will be saying, I want to be in his seat. I want to be standing where he is standing, type of thing. So that is part of the lesson. And just to, and remember that the Jewish women did get this lesson. I think it's always important to remember that. Jewish people, the Jewish women remembered that it is about the journey and it is about the bumps in life. We have that strength from the Jewish women to take it and to go with it and to realize that whatever our path is here, even if someone's in our seat and even if our key has many, many bumps, it's hard. Like I said to my daughter-in-law, you know, yeah, maybe, yeah, work hard because we do need Mashiach now. So let's do it so that we can get to the promised land.
So I just want to wrap the whole thing together. Now that we've heard what Simi said, and I really love the piece about the jagged edges of the key. That's really a really great depiction here. So now we understand. What's the story of the spies? They said, we just want to stay in the aura, in the field. There's clouds, there's automatic everything. We don't want to get it. We just like it here. We don't want to go there and do another whole job and get it right. Everything that Simi said. So how does the parasha end? Put on this aura. Put on the talit, and it has the details at the end. And believe me, making those strings correctly is all of those details. Because that's really what life has to be. Not like the spies wanted, just to be there out there, insulated, living in that aura of holiness. Get out in the world and have God's name in the details of your mundane activity. Right?